everyone to this session today, where we are very pleased to have Professor Dan Hicks with us. Dan is Curator of World Archaeology at Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, where he is also Professor of Contemporary Archaeology in the School of Archaeology at the University of Oxford and a Fellow at St. Cross College. Is the author of a number of works, most recently the author of a magnificent book called The Brutish Museums, which has been having a wonderful series of launches and panels and discussions around the world, and a number of them coming up. So it is really a pleasure to have Dan with us. So Dan, I suppose it would be useful to start with your setting at the University of Oxford and at Pitt Rivers Museum, where, because you experience these debates and these questions, not just as a scholar, but also as a curator.
A large sort of element of our work is to keep objects sort of the same, to conserve things, to ensure that the textiles are not eaten by the moths, and that the metalwork is not eroded and corroding. But sometimes we have experienced a sort of emission creep, through which we've imagined our role to be to halt the world around us, outside the museum, from continuing to change. And I think that in some ways, maybe that is sort of what a museum is. It's a space where you hold a moment in time. It's a space not so much of a sort of freeze frame as as an endurance. So the museum as a durational technology, rather than a simple presentation of sort of time as if it weren't moving, I think is sort of maybe what something like the Pitt Rivers or other ethnological museums are. In the past 5 to 10 years, if I look back over my own practice, if I look at how anthropology has worked, archaeology has changed, how the museum has altered, it feels like a revolutionary change in the way that sort of Kuhn, described. And that change, is a social change. It's a change which is driven by a series of African-led movements. It's a change that relates to social justice movements. But absolutely, we're seeing, in the museum, as I say in the book, we're sort of seeing the ethnological museum now, in a way that we didn't before, and in a way that is because the museum has failed. So exactly the same as if a car won't start in the morning, and you're on your way somewhere, and suddenly you see the car, in a way that you wouldn't see it on any other normal morning. You see things when they fail. And we're seeing the ethnological museum, we're seeing the colonial museum now, and we're having this conversation really because, it has failed.
Your book undertakes this beautiful critique of these ideas of co-curatorship and the idea also simply of the move into object biography and what our German-speaking colleagues call Provenienzforschung, where indeed you call for instead of biography, you call for necrology, and you point to a certain kind of death history of the object. And I wonder whether this isn't an appropriate moment for you to explain the sequences of the argument that your book goes through.
Sure, yeah. So the necrographic, in terms of actually how we rethink sort of provenance research as sort of writing death histories, and the necrological, the knowledge of death, the awareness of loss, you know, is really one of the central arguments of the book. But, I mean, of course, objects have always moved from A to B, you know, and objects even have been sort of taken as part of war. But in the late 19th century, looting became something very, very different. It became, in the context of informal empire, in the protectorates of the British, in, you know, in other such sort of situations, it became a, you know, a, you know, military technology for the denial of sovereignty and the destruction of non-Christian religions. So the Pitt Rivers in part is filled with things which were taken, you know, under such circumstances and were displayed in order to reinforce a particular sort of race science, a particular sort of white supremacy, a display of things that were taken, as the Pitt Rivers case actually used to say, from the dead enemies. And it's only last year, actually, did we, you know, take down the case, which was called the treatment of dead enemies, that operated almost as the introductory case for the Pitt Rivers. And sort of where we go with that case is under review. But certainly, it seemed to me that we couldn't talk about these, you know, those objects that were taken in this way. It wasn't appropriate to talk about life histories. And here, actually, Achille Mbembe's work, his you know, reframing of the Foucauldian notion of the biopolitical in the context of the, you know, the movement of displaced people from Africa and the Middle East, you know, into fortress Europe, and the, you know, the deaths, you know, week by week and day by day of Africans, you know, in the Mediterranean, at the borders of empire, at the borders of Europe, you know, which is a sort of enduring nature of empire. So the necrographic is an attempt to find some language, because ideas, I mean, so many of, you know, I work in a university museum. So many of these objects in our museums, you know, we are sort of keenly aware of here, actually are, you know, about knowledge as much as they're about, you know, property and identity. So, you know, actually, it turns out that the words we use, the concepts that we use to frame these things are incredibly important, you know, and they have histories. So, yeah, I think, I mean, that's one example among sort of several in the book where there's a bit of inventing of new language, which who knows if, you know, these are the right words. But it's certainly, I think what is absolutely true, you know, is that the language that we have available to us at the moment is, you know, really not fit for purpose. And we need sometimes to reverse, sometimes to invert, you know, ideas which are so familiar to us if we're going to tackle, you know, these histories, not just as, you know, things we describe, but as things which are enduring in the present.
Your book indeed is a strategic text, you know, about rethinking museology and rethinking the museum outside of its colonial entrapment.
You know, I think a big part of where we've been going wrong in our museums is not that, you know, we have leaders in our sector who are sort of personally racist, or are, you know, not interested in these questions, or are, you know, uncaring. I think what's happened is that we have, though, leaders in our sector who simply haven't realized what the ethnological museum is. They haven't understood its history as enduring into the present. They haven't understood how white supremacy from the 1880s, you know, up until the 1930s, sought out culture. It sought out memorialization in the form of the Confederate statue, in the form of the image here in the UK of Colston or Rhodes. You know, remembering Colston was a 17th century slaver who is remembered in 1895 in Bristol. You know, there's a very specific time frame in which, you know, anti-Black violence and a vision of white supremacy is actively, you know, naturalized in our built environment, in the very fabric of our cultural institutions. So culture was put to work for the purposes of a white supremacist vision. And so why is it that every Universal Museum has to have a Benin bronze? Why is it when they opened the Louvre Abu Dhabi that they had to have a Benin bronze for it to be a proper, you know, Universal Museum? Why does the story of the defeat of the Oba in 1897 have to be told in, you know, scores of museums, from St. Petersburg to LA, from, you know, Belfast to Ipswich? I mean, you know, what is this about? It has to be surely the case that a certain vision of the world, an incredibly powerful vision, was sort of built into culture, knowing that when you erect a statue, when you put a display into a cabinet, it's incredibly hard to take that apart. As soon as we can start acknowledging that, we'll maybe be able to start the difficult but essential process of, you know, making our ethnological museums, you know, fit for the 21st century, to keep them in step, you know, with our times. So fundamentally, the book, and there are other concepts, the idea of the chronopolitical, the sense that the Benin bronzes were displayed alongside ancient Egypt in order to tell the story that this sort of living kingdom that had just been destroyed is kind of dead, that it can be treated as if it's ancient Egypt, you know, which sort of feeds off so many other, you know, long-term anthropology visions of, you know, Africa, of the global south, as being somehow not only distant from Europe but also sort of in the past, in a different time period, you know, not in the contemporary world. So yeah, for all those reasons, I think we have to acknowledge the role of sort of whiteness in the museum. And so maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I would have told you that the Pitt Rivers is a, you know, is a vehicle, is a device for the production of alterity, for the enacting of the idea of the primitive, for the creation of difference. All these, you know, racist tropes of sort of savagery, of sort of barbarism, were created. You know, and of course that's entirely true. But I would add to that another level of awareness, which would be very different. It's almost the exact inverse of that, you know, rather 90s sort of Jim Clifford style reflexive anthropology approach, which is that, well, all those things are going on and these societies are being objectified and so the people are being sort of turned into objects. But what's happening on the other side of the case? What's happening, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s, what is going on with the human and the living space of the gallery? There is the production of whiteness. There is the inscription, the racialization of the visitor, of the curator, of the researcher, as, you know, the inverse of these cultures that are objectified. You're on the right side of the glass. You're on the living side of the case. You're not, you're not incarcerated in this box. You're free to walk. You're living and breathing and moving. And that's incredibly powerful in terms of what the museum does. And yet we haven't seen it. We haven't seen the role of the museum as a device for telling you that you're different.
As long as those relics, those dead bodies, or those dead artifacts are in our museum. How would you like to mediate this necrography inside the museum space, as long as those objects are here, because it will take time to restitute everything, perhaps. So this in-between period, and this is the museum at the moment. We don't know where we go to exactly, but here we are, and we have those dead bodies.
So a big part of what this means for us is, well, I think number one, we take human remains off display, fundamentally. We have to have a much wider conversation, which isn't about the very slow work of restitution on a case-by-case basis for human remains, even though that's important. But it's also, we need to start tackling the vast majority of those human remains for which we're never going to find a source community. You know, whenever it just says Africa, it just says Asia, it might not say anything on the body, on the skull. Why are we keeping these things? Why are we just going to ignore them? Are we just going to hide them away? There was a moment, a week and a half ago or so, where Harvard University made a statement about the fact that their 22,000 individuals represented in their human remains collections may include some enslaved African Americans. Well, you know, how is it that we haven't had this conversation yet? How is it that we've thought that we can just hide these things in the stores so no one knows about them and we'll just ignore them? So it isn't only what we do in the exhibition space, it's what we do in the store. And it isn't only about human remains, it's about mixing that up with having the same conversation with cultural objects as well. But yeah, I mean, I think we need to start actively to physically dismantle our displays. And I want to imagine, as I'm sure you do, a museum where nothing is stolen, where we have no human skulls on display, where we are, you're doing the crucial work of the World Culture Museum, which is work that we've never needed more, I think, you know, in the history of the idea of world culture. We've never needed more a space where we can celebrate and experience creativity and thought and belief and sort of worldviews outside of a Eurocentric perspective. We've actually never needed that more than we do right now. But that doesn't mean that we can't sort of tackle these sort of cancerous, you know, elements that are eating away at the heart of the museum and always have done. These sort of your time bombs, which were set up in the 1880s, the 1920s, which we have to defuse, we have to extract, you know, we can't ignore anymore. So, yeah, there's no, there is no easy answer. And exactly as you say, you know, restitution is not going to happen overnight. You know, Rome was not unbuilt in a day. You know, it takes time. But that doesn't mean that we, in this intervening time, let's not allow it to just turn into endless dialogue, endless, you know, just introspection, the reflexive term that yet again re-centers the white curator, except this time is very sensitive and very honest and yet still retelling the histories which are so hurtful to so many.
So I wonder if we could also imagine a new museum from the perspective of the communities it produces, assuming that we want a museum that produces communities rather than reaching out to audiences. Benedict Anderson wrote about the early museum that it's producing imagined communities, that it was a tool to produce the narrative of a nation. And if we now think of a post-national community, who could that be? How can we produce that with a museum and also vice versa?
I guess, fundamentally, we have to start with who we are in terms of those of us that work in museums. you know, the sheer whiteness of this conversation is reflected in every conversation we have among museum colleagues and academics working in this sector, which is a major part of what, you know, white infrastructure is also us, right? And the until we start looking like the communities that we claim we represent, then we're not really going to be able to start this important work that you describe. So here at Oxford, a part of how we're addressing colonial legacies is through the positive action programs, which are there for our training, for masters and for doctoral training. We are targeting the Black and minority ethnic communities who are underrepresented in our student body, so we can begin to diversify ourselves as a field. So racism in this context is not about actively being personally racist. It's about the structures of institutions. It's about modes of thought. It's about unthinking practices that continually discriminate, that continually exclude. So we haven't started that conversation about what museums, how are museums institutionally racist? Because it's not, it isn't just, how is it that we are continuing to exclude? How do we continue to recruit in our own image and to reproduce this sort of problem? So I think I don't have any easy answers, but this is fundamentally about moving away from the decolonization of museums, as the phraseology, into being anti-colonial.